Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses President Obama's justification for U.S. military intervention in Libya's conflict, outlined in his March 28th address to the nation. Palestinian academic and activist Mazen Kumsia, author of Popular Resistance in Palestine, who discusses the calls for reconciliation between opposing Palestinian political parties, Fatah and Hamas. And Tom Clemens of Friends of the Earth, who explains why his and other groups have filed a Freedom of Information Act request for U.S. government radiation monitoring data from Japan's Fukushima nuclear disaster. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new research study by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has raised doubts about the use of natural gas as a transitional fuel toward a clean energy future. The EPA analysis of the pollution generated during the entire natural gas production process uncovered new high levels of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas released during drilling activity. The United States currently has large reserves of natural gas. While natural gas is cleaner than other fossil fuels and safer than nuclear power, the EPA analysis could slow down the current campaign by the natural gas industry for new government subsidies to exploit natural gas potential as an alternative fuel for cars and to build scores of new gas-fired power plants. According to estimates from Carnegie Mellon University energy specialist Paulina Jaramillo, half of the gas-fired power plants in the U.S. operate at the dirtier end of the emission spectrum, only running 30% cleaner than coal power plants. In 2005, state legislatures around the U.S. began passing tough anti-immigration laws, but the Christian Science Monitor reports these laws have had little impact on the flow of undocumented immigrants across the border. Harsh legislation, such as Arizona's controversial SB 1070, reflects an angry white backlash against Latino immigrants, but has had little enforcement impact. So far, there have been no arrests under the Arizona law, which gives local police the right to check a person's immigration status. Another tough anti-immigrant law passed in 2007 by Oklahoma, HB 1804, bars immigrants from receiving certain state benefits. Yet in its first year of enforcement, only three immigrants were arrested. Over the past year, more than a dozen states, mostly in the South, have debated similar restrictions on undocumented immigrants. In mid-March, Utah Governor Gary Herbert signed a bill giving police the power to check the immigration status of persons convicted of serious crimes. Since the passage of Arizona's SB 1070 law, over 100,000 Latinos have left the state. Former Phoenix resident Alicia Sandoval, who moved to Ohio, blamed the exodus on the anti-immigrant crackdown by Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who helped deport over 26,000 immigrants in the 3 years before SB 1070 took effect in 2010. In 2010, General Electric, one of America's largest corporations, had a banner year, taking in $14.2 billion in global profits, including over $5 billion from U.S. operations. Still, GE is seeking a taxpayer refund from the IRS of over $3 billion. According to the New York Times, GE has worked for years to cut its tax bill through aggressive lobbying in Washington, D.C., and hiring scores of top lobbyists and tax experts. GE has finessed the fine art of exploiting corporate tax loopholes while transferring industrial production overseas. GE's giant tax department is run by former U.S. Treasury official John Samuels, whose office is filled with former congressional staffers and former Internal Revenue Service officials. In recent years, GE lobbyists have pushed for a more rapid depreciation for its jet engines and green power credits for wind turbines. The company also led a full court press to preserve its tax advantages in 2008 by lobbying then-House Ways and Means Chairman Charlie Rangel. After Rangel got on board, the GE Foundation donated over $30 million to New York City schools, including $11 million going to schools in Rangel's Harlem district. 2 years later, Rangel was sanctioned by Congress for ethics violations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Nine days after ordering the Pentagon to launch attacks on Muammar Gaddafi's air defenses and ground troops, along with an international coalition, President Obama delivered a nationally televised speech designed to defend that decision. In his March 28th address to the National Defense University, Obama justified the U.S. intervention in Libya by maintaining that the rebel-held city of Benghazi was on the brink of a humanitarian disaster, with Gaddafi's forces closing in and the promise of a bloodbath. He also told Americans that the multinational effort he had organized was needed in Libya to avoid a repetition of the nation's costly war in Iraq. The president also pledged that NATO, which the U.S. is the most important member, will take over leading enforcement of the UN-mandated no-fly zone over Libya. But while reaction varied, with most Democrats offering support and most Republicans leveling criticism, several important questions remained unanswered in the president's speech. What will the U.S. military do to support the president's stated goal of removing Gaddafi from power? What's the exit strategy for the U.S. if the rebels are unable to defeat Gaddafi's forces and Libya's people find themselves in a long, bloody civil war? Other questions focused on the unknown political character and goals of Libyan opposition groups, whose rebel fighters have lost ground to government troops in recent days. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She takes a critical look at President Obama's speech and his decision to intervene in the Libyan conflict.
Well, you know, I think, Scott, that we already are involved in a third war in the Middle East, and unfortunately, President Obama's speech didn't do much to assuage that fear. It was a good speech. President Obama can be a great communicator. It was a powerful speech. It was an emotive speech. But it didn't answer a lot of the key questions that people have been asking. The questions remained. The question of why didn't he consult with Congress? There was no real discussion about what the U.S. plan is. He said, basically, our position is we want regime change. But our military isn't involved in that because the military is restricted by what the UN resolution says, and that's just about protecting civilians. So, of course, we're not going to move towards regime change with our military. The problem, of course, is that I don't think anybody really believes that. When you have the commander-in-chief telling the military, we want regime change, but we want you to be very careful about what you do, that's a real mixed message that I don't think really works very well. And then you have the problem of what the end game looks like. We didn't hear anything about the Libyan opposition. There's lots of questions about that. The problem that we have here is that this isn't just a revolutionary process that we're watching and cheering. This is one where our government, our tax money, our military is actively fighting with them. These are now our guys. So the question of who they are becomes much more important. And, of course, President Obama couldn't answer that because, frankly, I don't think they have a clue either. I would love to believe that President Obama is really trying to create a new foreign policy, a foreign policy based on internationalism, based on taking care of people in other nations. But as long as our actual policy enables those violations everywhere else, and the one place we decide to do something about it, it's a military assault, then I can't accept it. Then I find it just too hard to believe.
Phyllis, in a recent article, you talked about the prospect and your concern about a long war in Libya, especially given the fact that the United States, President Obama specifically, calling for the ouster of Gaddafi. The United States and its allies seem to be running air cover for the rebel movement. Maybe you could expand on your concern about how this could devolve into a very long adventure.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that without clarity that the role of the United States is or is not to be a partisan, a partner, a military backer of the opposition forces, which is the role that, our troops are playing now. There's no question about that, but it's not acknowledged quite that way. U.S. planes and French planes have, among other things, attacked retreating regime tanks and troops, attacked planes on the ground, attacked an airfield hundreds or maybe even thousands of kilometers away from any civilians, attacked military barracks. So they've gone far beyond this notion of simply immediate protection of the civilians in Benghazi, for instance. The problem is that absent the complete overthrow of Gaddafi's regime, which probably would mean that Gaddafi would be killed somehow along the way, I don't quite see how else that would happen, the possibility is far more likely, I think, that there will be a division of the country between a Gaddafi-controlled Western sector and essentially a Western protectorate in the east, a NATO-US protectorate of some sort in the eastern part of Libya, where, conveniently enough, the oil happens to be located. The temporary interim government already signed their first oil contract yesterday with some foreign oil company. But the possibility of a long-term stalemate with the country divided, occasional flare-ups of violence, but the involvement remaining of U.S., NATO, other forces, it could go on for a very long time. This was actually anticipated in the U.N. resolution. There's a reference to a request to the Secretary General of the U.N. It asks him to report to the Security Council about the military developments in Libya within 7 days and every month thereafter. So it was implying that they believed that this is something that it was going to go on for months at least. President Obama tried in his speech tonight to sort of say, well, we're pulling back, we're not the main ones, by implication sort of saying, and therefore we don't have to worry about it going on too long, but it doesn't really work that way. The U.S. is still the main component of NATO, so having NATO command and control doesn't mean the U.S. isn't there. We're still the main military force. It's primarily U.S. planes. The U.S. has flown something like 199 military sorties in the last few days. The Brits have flown two. So that's kind of the divide of who's doing what at this point.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is author of the new book titled Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer. Find links to Bennis's recent articles on the Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The March 11th murder of five members of an Israeli settler family in their West Bank home, followed by the March 23rd bombing of a bus in Jerusalem that killed one person and injured more than 30 others, has greatly increased tension between Israelis and Palestinians. Mortars and rockets fired into Israel by Palestinian militants from Gaza and Israeli airstrikes on Gaza have resulted in further civilian deaths and dozens of injuries. Against the backdrop of increased violence, Palestinian academic and activist Mazen Kumsaya is touring the U.S. with his new book titled Popular Resistance in Palestine. It traces the history of nonviolent struggles for self-determination throughout the 20th century and into the 21st, including opposition to Israeli occupation. It focuses on the Palestinian people's demand that international law and human rights be upheld in the struggle for a just solution to the Middle East conflict. His book tour was part of Israeli Apartheid Week, which was organized globally during the last week of March. The Week of Actions was an effort to support Palestinian civil society's call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel as a nonviolent means of opposing Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and suppression of Palestinian rights. During one of Kumsaya's recent talks at Yale University, where he once taught, he took questions from members of the audience who held a variety of viewpoints on the Middle East. In this segment, we first hear Kumsaya's response to a questioner who asked why the Palestinian author doesn't support what he described as moderates on both sides to reach a just resolution, rather than holding a radical position himself, thereby emboldening radicals on the Israeli side.
Well, I think this construct that says that There's a particular type of moderation. The moderation is the people who accept that Israel is a Jewish state on 78% of Palestine and are willing to negotiate on part of the remaining 22% if they renounce the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, and if they renounce their basic human rights to their own lands and properties, and if they do A, B, C, D, then they become moderate and would be acceptable as negotiating partners, to me, is not a correct construct to think of this situation. It's like saying, why not concentrate on the moderates in South Africa under apartheid? The Chief Buthelezi, for example, who was more than willing to recognize white South Africa in its current borders with the Bantustans where they are, and was more than happy to sit down with whites in South Africa and deal on this preconception of what is right and wrong, and in so doing, of course, abandon the rights of his own people. The Bantu people had rights. They had rights to the land. Now, the question is really not an issue of moderates versus extremists. You have to define these terms. What is moderate? What is extremist? I consider Hamas extremist. Let's be very clear, okay? I consider Likud to be extremist. I consider Kadima to be extremist. I consider Labour Party in Israel to be extremist. Why? Because all of them say that Palestinians do not have the rights to their lands, that Palestinian refugees cannot go back to their lands. This is a basic human right. Do we support it or don't you support it?
Another person asked whether under the new Egyptian government that is emerging after the departure of President Hosni Mubarak, Kumsia thinks that will result in an end to the blockade of Gaza from the Egyptian side.
I hope so, I pray so, but so far we haven't seen the change in Egyptian policy. Part of it, of course, is that the Egyptians still get over $1 billion from the U.S., primarily for their military, and the U.S. still has a lot of leverage in Egypt on the military, and now the military is in charge in this transition period. So until the fair and free elections that we were promised from the military, and they are following up on some of their promises, like with the change in the constitution and so forth. They did the referendum on that. So if they continue this and they do get a representative Egyptian government that represents the will of the Egyptian people, I can tell you I have many friends in Egypt. And they tell me a big part of this uprising in Egypt was about that subject. A big part of it was, how could you starve 1.5 million people to serve the Israeli government interest by collaborating with Israel and sealing the borders of Gaza?
I was able to ask the last question. Can you comment on the recent efforts of young Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza to call for reunification of the Palestinian leadership?
I myself am not for this notion of unifying Palestinian leadership, because Hamas and Fatah has two different ideologies and they will never come together. It's like asking Republicans and Democrats to form one party. It would be very difficult, I think, in this situation. So they have a very different ideology. So there were demonstrations 15 of March, which was called the Day of Rage in Palestine. Thousands and thousands of Palestinians went in demonstrations in Gaza and in the West Bank against both Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank, telling them, stop this charade. They did not call, come make unity between you two. No, they said, we want, as Palestinians, we want you to go back to being a representative Palestinian National Council that represents all Palestinians and not just Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, but the 1.5 million who are inside the Green Line, plus all the refugees in diaspora. If you recreate the Palestinian National Council, that in itself will bring reconciliation, because it would be a democratic institution. That's what they called for. Both Hamas and Fatah, by the way, hijacked this message and started sending message to their supporters saying that the demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza were about reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. That this was a distortion of the message of what we had been calling for. And actually, in both places, they failed with this message among Palestinians, with trying to distort our message.
That was Mazen Kumsia, a professor at Bethlehem and Birzeit Universities in the West Bank. His new book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment, is published by Pluto Press. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information, visit our website at btlonline.org. As the crisis at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant complex entered its third week, there were growing concerns about soil samples collected near the plant that revealed the presence of small amounts of plutonium. All nuclear power plants produce small amounts of plutonium within protected uranium fuel rods, but Fukushima's Unit No. 3 reactor uses a mix of uranium and plutonium, or MOX, fuel. The soil tests could indicate that there may be a dangerous breach of the No. 3 reactor's containment vessel. Plutonium, with a half-life of more than 24,000 years, is one of the most dangerous substances known on Earth. When it enters the body through the air, in drinking water, or in food, plutonium can damage DNA and cause cancers. Radiation has also been detected in the ocean near the stricken nuclear plant. Irradiated water contaminated with iodine-131 and cesium-137 is thought to have leached back into the ocean after emergency workers poured seawater into the reactors to cool them down after the March 11th earthquake and tsunami crippled the plant's emergency water pumps. One of the biggest concerns about cesium-137, with a half-life of 30 years, is its ability to be absorbed by marine plants and fish, concentrating as it moves up the food chain. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Clements, Southeastern Nuclear Campaign Coordinator with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. He talks about the dangers various levels of radiation pose to human health and explains why his group has filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking U.S. government radiation monitoring data that was used on March 16th to issue a call for a 50-mile evacuation radius for Americans in Japan near the Fukushima nuclear complex.
Now it appears from what we've seen that plutonium has been picked up near to the reactor site, although I think the government once again is saying it's normal levels that show up all around other nuclear power plants. But this reactor did have the plutonium fuel in it, mixed oxide fuel. It was shipped from France. It's a byproduct of reprocessing of spent fuel, where plutonium is not a natural element, and the plutonium was removed in France, made into fuel, shipped back quite some time ago to Japan, and loaded in this Unit 3, which is having the gravest problems, back in September. It had about 5% plutonium fuel, so any breach in the reactor, and by this time we would have expected the fuel to have melted to the bottom. So there's a question if, beyond some kind of breaching and cracking, is that material, which is called corium, because it's in the core of the reactor, just a melted mass, is it going to burn through the bottom of the reactor? And there's a lot of plutonium in there, and it appears some of it is being released to the environment. I'm sitting here in South Carolina. Everybody knows now it's raining outside here, and all the nuclear facilities in South Carolina, and I've seen it in Massachusetts, they picked it up as well, and across the country there, small amounts of radioactive iodine, which is very volatile material are being detected, including here into the Savannah Riverside, which is a big DOE facility. So, and I've heard they picked it up in Ireland as well. So this is a global phenomenon that's of growing concern.
When we talk about Unit 3 and its plutonium and the samples of soil around the Fukushima plant that authorities there have said they found plutonium in the soil, what does this mean for the people of Japan and for the rest of us?
Well, plutonium is fairly heavy, so it might not travel that far. It's according to what the mechanism is, but I think probably the greatest risk is if there are so-called hot spots of plutonium where there's actually an agglomeration of particles in one place that could lead to pretty intense exposure. One of the Chernobyl people who was here in Columbia, South Carolina over the last few days talked about identifying these hot spots, which really may present a longer-term threat. And one good thing is that they may only be localized, but if this material is somehow lofted into the atmosphere further and the wind is blowing back towards the main island or towards Tokyo, this could present a very, very long-term health threat. The half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years, and the rule of thumb is it takes about 10 radioactive half-lives for the material to become safe. So that's 240,000 years, and there's really no way to clean it up once it gets there. Cesium, which is very bad, has a shorter half-life, and iodine, it's only about a week. But the isotopes like plutonium are going to hang around forever, and I think we may well be looking at a Chernobyl-type evacuation zone or exclusion zone that becomes an uninhabited zone around the reactor. And I think one reason the Japanese don't want to declare their evacuation zone up to 30 kilometers is because that's the size of the Chernobyl zone right now that people can't live in.
If you're correct in the reasons why they haven't gone to a wider area of evacuation, and it has to do with public relations, that's frightening. I mean, that is downright horrendous, immoral, frightening stuff.
Well, I think that is. And also, they don't want to panic the people within that zone, but Greenpeace has called for a wider zone, and Greenpeace has sent a team over to do monitoring. There have been radiation monitors sent by U.S. groups over to Japan. They're trying to get money to send more over because people know that they can't trust what is being told to them by the authorities.
Your group, Friends of the Earth, and a couple of other organizations have actually put in for a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in the United States to get some of the data that they have found in Japan, because the NRC does have monitoring equipment in Japan and over Japan, I guess, with certain flights that have been checking the radioactivity level in the skies above Japan.
Yes, it was with Physicians for Social Responsibility and Nuclear Information and Resource Service. A lawyer filed the FOIA request for us, but we want the full monitoring data, not just a sample that's been released. And actually, it may be more important, at least to me, we want the protocol, why they're doing this, where they're providing the information, what their analysis of the information is, as well as the raw data. We've asked for them to respond to this Freedom of Information Act request on an expedited manner, because we think people should know what's being detected and picked up. The international public should know, but, you know, they should be releasing this information. We shouldn't have to be prodding and goading our own government to do the right thing, but you know, it takes activist groups like ours to do this, and we're going to continue to push them.
That was Tom Clements, Southeastern Nuclear Campaign Coordinator with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Find the link to the group's Fukushima Freedom of Information Act request at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tak. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Van Zari.